Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming up on episode 225 of Wheel Bearings, it's just Robbie and me, and we talk about the Hyundai Kona EV Limited, transitioning connected cars from 3G to 4G, expanding production of the Ford Mustang Mach-E, Elon Musk railing against EV incentives, the VW ID. Buzz camper is coming, and the Tesla Cybertruck has just one windshield wiper. All that and more coming up next. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. This is episode 225 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abual-Samage from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from Digital Trends.
And Nicole is off, taking a little vacation time this week, and then she'll be popping in to where her daughter's going to college and driving back home back to New Hampshire with her daughter for the holidays. So she'll be back with us next week when we will, all three of us, we're believe it or not, the three of us were actually all in the same physical location for a short period of time earlier this week.
It was weird. We talked about pie.
Yeah. In the 5 years of doing this show through the various hosts, there has never been a time when all the hosts were actually physically present in the same location at once until this past Tuesday night.
Wow.
The first time ever.
I could touch them. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And that was, to be fair, that was the first time I think I've ever met Nicole in real life.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think we've just sort of missed each other. I've seen you a ton of times.
Yeah.
But Nicole, that was the first time I've ever seen Nicole in real life. So it was a nice experience. And again, we talked about pie. Because of Nicole, I bought a pie and then I transported it all over California and finally to my house like 3 days later.
I saw one of your tweets, I think, where did the pie end up upside down at some point?
The pie, okay, so I stuck it in the back of a car. I stuck it in the back of the AMG EQS upside down for just a split second. I stuck it in. I'm like, oh, no, and I flipped it back over. So that's when it may have So I decided not to look at the pie until afterwards, like a little surprise. So by the time I got it home, it was more of a cobbler. And less of a pie.
Yeah, that's okay because, I mean, once it gets in your mouth, all the pieces get mixed up anyway. I mean, unless you're particular about, like, only eating crust and then only eating filling in separate bites.
Nah.
It's kind of pointless.
I heated some up at home the other day, and I stuck it in our little toaster oven, and it went in upside down. And I'm like, you know what? At this point, it doesn't matter. Just warmed it up upside down, ate it. It was fine.
Yeah. So for the listeners, we were driving the Hyundai Ioniq 5 earlier this week, and the drive impressions are still embargoed until next week. And when Nicole's back, we will talk about that in I'm sure significant depth. But the place where we had our lunch stop was in Julian, California, and across the street from the restaurant where we ate was the Julian Pie Company. I think it was the Julian Pie Company, right?
Pie Company.
And so a number of people bought pies to take home with them. And I had a slice of the pie with my dessert for lunch, and it was most excellent.
It was very good. And then and Nicole is the person who talked me into buying an entire pie. Because they're like, oh, you can get a pie. Because I was just going to go across the street the next day and get a donut and some cider. That's it. That's all I was going to get. And then I just kept hearing Nicole. She's like, you should get the appleberry one. And then that's what I got, the appleberry one. And then I after I bought it, I was like, what am I going to do with this? Because I had another drive program with two other cars that are embargoed, two Mercedes that I can't talk about now. But I had to get on a plane with it and then multiple, like, shuttles to and from the airport. And is yeah, by the time I got to my house, it was in 8 vehicles and 2 planes.
I decided that, you know, I just didn't want to deal with having to carry a pie around through airports and planes and stuff like that.
See, you're the smart one. I'm like, pie. But I got home, and my wife, who spent half of her childhood in San Diego, she's like, oh, a Julian pie, which I was like, wow, I didn't know this was, yeah, I guess this is really a thing.
It's a thing in San Diego.
There you go.
All right. So, well, with that out of the way.
Our non-con related car related rant.
Is there anything that you've been driving that you can talk about this week?
I'm right now, I'm behind the wheel of the X5 plug-in hybrid, but I just got it. So I haven't had a real chance to drive it yet. So I don't want to talk about it. I'll probably talk about next week. Everything else I drove, I can't talk about. Yeah, nothing. I can't tell you that the X5 will fit a 2-foot by 4-foot piece of MDF board in the back and polycarbonate.
With the back seats up?
With the back seats down. It's oh, yeah, okay. It's pretty big. So that's what I can tell you. And clear 6-foot long tubes. Those will fit back there as well. That's there you go. There's your car review, people. Put that on the internet.
We'll get more detail on that next week.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have had after I got home on Thursday night from driving the newest Hyundai EV in California, I picked up from the airport the current Hyundai EV, which is the Kona Electric, which is the same thing that you and your wife own.
We bought it.
Yeah. So it's the 2022 Kona Electric, the Limited is the one that I have. It comes in 2 trim levels, the SEL and the Limited, and it's been refreshed this year, revised front end design, some other trim changes, and they've pared it down to just the 2 trims, the SEL and the Limited, and they dropped the price on the SEL, so the base model now starts at just $34,000 sticker price, assuming of course that you can find one. And then the Limited has pretty much all the options available on it. So some of the things that you miss if you opt for the SEL, and it may not be a miss depending on where you live and what your needs are, but the Limited gets the convenience package, which includes the sunroof, LED lamps, power driver's seat, heated and cooled front seats, leather trim steering wheel, the Hyundai digital key, and an assortment of other stuff, all as standard equipment. And some of those are available as options on the SEL trim. But even the base SEL, you know, I think you have an SEL, right?
Yes. We have most of those things. We don't have like adaptive cruise control. There's like weird things. You're like, wait, does it have this? No, it doesn't have that.
So you still get a lot of stuff. And interestingly, I was looking at the differences between the SEL and the Limited. And one peculiar thing that stood out to me is, you know, on the SEL, the SEL, you get a standard 8-inch center touchscreen for the infotainment system, which is a very good touchscreen. It's got Hyundai's interface on there. It works really well. Hyundai does a great job sourcing their displays. You know, unlike some other automakers, you know, their displays are always very clearly visible, even in direct sunlight. Good contrast. They never look dim. So you get the 8-inch screen on the SEL, and for 2022, they added wireless support for both Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, so you don't actually have to plug in your phone once you've paired it. The Limited has a 10.25-inch screen. It's a little bigger, a little wider screen, slightly different user interface, graphical interface on the infotainment system, but it only has support for wired CarPlay and Android Auto. So you do have to plug in your phone via USB to use CarPlay or Android Auto, even though it's, you know, on the more expensive car with the bigger screen. But, you know, that's a minor inconvenience. And strangely enough, you also get wireless charging on the Limited, which you don't get on the SEL. So
no, we have wireless charging. It doesn't work. Oh, it's the one thing that doesn't work. We have the little logo. It has everything that you should work. But it doesn't. Maybe, you know, I'm gonna take it. I have to take the Hyundai and get it fixed. But we have wireless.
Maybe they ran out of chips for that.
Maybe.
Some automakers have been disabling stuff like that where they don't have chips available.
Maybe I'll we haven't, it hasn't been an issue, but it's really weird that the 10.5 doesn't.
Yeah. Wireless. Well, yeah, you know, and especially, you know, on the wireless, you know, the version that supports wireless Android Auto and CarPlay, you know, that's when you would actually want a wireless charger more, because, you know, you just take your phone, drop it down on the charging pad. You don't have to plug anything in, you know, but because it's projecting stuff to the screen, you know, it is going to have some battery drain. So it's nice to have the wireless pad. You can just drop your phone on there and you're done. But on the Limited, where you it comes standard with the wireless charging pad, but you have to plug in your phone anyway to use it with the system. So
That's okay. So, but it does have the more updated the more updated infotainment screen. Right?
It does, yeah. So you get.
I wonder if there's a software issue with that, because we have the older version where you're like, oh, it doesn't have that like really beautiful like sort of splash screen, home screen with all the, like, ooh, we don't have that.
Yeah, and you know, and of course on that infotainment system on the Limited, you of course do get sounds of nature. Which,
yeah, we don't get coffee shop or rain or any of that.
Well, especially on an EV, because they're so quiet, you know, having that could, you know, might actually be very pleasant.
I was looking for it. I was like, oh, I was all excited. I'm like, oh, we don't have it. Oh, it kind of broke my heart that was the one thing we didn't have. And I was adaptive cruise control. I'm like, whatever. You know, it's wonderful when you're going on long trips, but for the most part, I only use it to test it, and be for long drives. For the when I'm just driving around, or if I'm stuck in traffic. But the car is really my wife's car, so I don't typically get stuck in traffic with it. So,
So you know, the Kona is, you know, it's smaller than the Ioniq 5 is. You know, it's a fairly small, it's quite a compact crossover. You know, but you know, front seats are great. The back seats are definitely a little more snug. You know, somebody your height, Robbie, might be challenged in the back seat.
That's where the dogs sit.
Yeah. You know, I mean, for me, I'm 5'10", 5'11", and I kind of just barely fit in there. You know, when I set the driver's seat for where I would be, I just barely fit behind that in the back seat. But, you know, for short trips, you know, going out to dinner or whatever, you know, or with kids, you know, if you've got younger kids, they'll be fine back there. And you've got a decent amount of cargo space in the back. You know, it's quite fun to drive, you know, the 200 horsepower motor, you know, it's got plenty of pickup, not a problem there at all. And it's also very efficient. You know, it's rated at 258 miles of range. You know, it's been pretty cold here these past several days, although it did get warm briefly yesterday, got up to almost 60 yesterday morning before it dropped back down to 30 again.
Shorts weather.
Yeah. You know, so because with that cold weather, when I picked it up from the airport, it was fully charged, but it was showing 235 miles of range, 232 miles, I think. But it's doing really well. You know, it's getting like 3.8 miles per kilowatt hour, which is quite good. I mean, that's about as good as anything you're going to find out there today. And
in the cold, it's getting that, right?
Yeah, and it's getting that in the cold.
All right.
And, you know, in warm weather where you're not using the heater and things like that, you could probably get four miles per kilowatt hour or more, which is really quite exceptional. And, you know, for an EV that starts at $34,000, you know, to have, you know, almost 260 miles of range, you know, is really impressive. You know, for pretty much any other car that's got that kind of range, the only other one that gets similar range at that price point is the Chevy Bolt, which you can't actually get right now because they're not building them, because all the new batteries they're building are going into replacing the batteries in the Bolts. The Bolt is the closest you're going to get with that kind of range at that price point. Everything else that's out there that's got that kind of range right now, at least, is well over 40 grand. So, you know, with the $7,500 tax credit on there, you know, you can get this, you know, down to about 27,500, which, you know, is fantastic. I mean, it's actually a really good value, as you would expect from Hyundai. I really enjoy this. The last time I had one was a couple of years ago when it first launched, before they did the refresh on it. And at that time also happened to be when we were having a polar vortex here in Michigan in February. And it was actually even colder. It was like 17 degrees. And, you know, I still got, you know, over 200 miles of range out of it then, even in those temperatures. So if you're looking for a long range, relatively affordable EV, you know, and you don't need a huge amount of space, you know, then the Kona Electric is really an awesome option, I think.
Yeah, we were looking at the Bolt, because you can get the Bolt for like a nickel if you're a Costco member. Every once in a while they'll have these weird like lease options where you can get the Bolt almost as cheap as when you used to be able to get the Fiat 500e for like $100 a month. Mm-hmm. So they had like Bolts for like 150 something a month about 6 months ago, and so we had a Bolt in before it was taken away. And we were driving it, and my wife's like, why is this car riding so rough? She's like, it's not the BRZ. It shouldn't be like this. And so I was like, okay. It's because I was like, you know, we wanted to get an EV. And so, you know, I'd drive around with vehicles with her because she'd be the main driver. And it just kept coming back to the Hyundai. And after I talked her into Hyundai to just test drive it, because she had a Hyundai XL back in the '90s,
Were not something you actually wanted to own.
No, it was a horrible, horrible car. So it took a little bit of convincing just to test drive it. And so finally she drove and she's like, oh, I really like this. And now it's in our driveway, but it has a flat tire. She ran over, there was like an accident and like a piece of metal was in the road, and she didn't see it. She ran it over. Now there's this giant, like 2-inch gash in one of the tires, and it's going to take till Tuesday to get a new tire. So it's just sort of sitting there. So she's driving the BRZ to work the next few days. So she's probably, you know, doing burnouts and stuff. Who knows?
Yeah. The version, the Kona I have in the driveway right now is actually the limited model. So that is the higher end model that's loaded. And that one with, including the $1,185 delivery charge, which is relatively low by current standards, it comes to $43,840. So that, and that's basically all in. You know, I don't think there's really any options, any additional options you can get on that. So this is good. The only potential downside to this is the Kona only has support for 75 kilowatt charging. So it's not as fast as some of the latest EVs, including the Ioniq 5. Which will charge up to 230 kilowatts, which means it won't charge up quite as fast from a DC fast charger as some other newer EVs do. But, you know, for most people, that's probably fine. I went to my local neighborhood EA station yesterday and did some charging. And, you know, in about 20 minutes, you know, it added about, let's see, it put in about it went from 42% to 70% charge, you know, and again that was in cold weather. It was a little over 30 degrees, and it started off, you know, comparatively low at about 40 odd kilowatts, and then, you know, as the battery warmed up, it ramped up to almost 70 kilowatts charging rate. So it'll still charge at a pretty decent pace, just not as fast as the Ioniq 5 will charge from 10 to 80% charge in 18 minutes on a 350 kilowatt charger. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But other than that, there's nothing else I would really complain about on this car.
350 kilowatts. That's how fast that Kona will charge.
Yeah, it won't actually charge quite fast.
You can't. That's like when you get gigabit internet. Like, yeah. I have gigabit internet. I've never hit gigabit speed, but it's really quick.
Yeah. So that is the 2022 Hyundai Kona Electric. So let's dive into a few of the news items of the week. One of the big ones that's actually coming out. Robbie and I have both written about this. The stories will be coming out on, excuse me, before you hear this, but after we're recording this. And it's about one of the solutions for the transition for connected vehicles from 3G to 4G. And this is a problem we've had in the past with connected cars. As cellular technologies evolve, vehicles tend to last a lot longer than devices like smartphones and tablets. And so they tend to, sometimes the connectivity that they have goes obsolete long before the rest of the car does. This first happened in 2007 with the first generation of GM OnStar vehicles. Those cars had analog cellular connectivity, and that got shut down in 2007. And so those early years of OnStar systems just went bye-bye. They couldn't function anymore. It happened in the early 2010s with the 2G to 3G transition. With Nissan, for example, on the Leaf, the first few model years of the Leaf had 2G cellular in there. And when that got shut down around 2015 or 16, some of those cars lost connectivity when it went to 3G and 4G. And now we're having the 3G to 4G transition, where starting in February, AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon will be shutting down their 3G networks. And so cars that have 3G radios in them, in some cases, will lose connectivity. Not all of them, but some will. And one company that has got a solution for that is Audi, for at least some of their cars, working with a company called Mojio. Robbie, did you get a chance to talk to Mojio or Bosch or Audi about this?
I have not. I have not had a chance. I've just been running around like a chicken. I think the chance I had was while I was going to be behind the wheel of another car, unfortunately.
Okay. So I did have a call with Kyle McDonald, who's the VP of marketing at Mojio, and Paul Malhotra from Audi. And Alan Messer, also from Mojio, and somebody from Bosch, whose name unfortunately escapes me at the moment. And we talked about what they're doing. And Mojio's been around for about 9 years, I think, now, almost 10 years. And they were developed, they had OBD2 connectivity dongles that they were selling. They were working through. They never sold stuff direct to consumer. They went through other companies, and they also have built out a cloud infrastructure and apps to allow you to do some of the kinds of things. If you have built-in connectivity like OnStar or Hyundai BlueLink, some of that kind of functionality, but for older cars that don't have it built in, they have this adapter that plugs into the OBD2 port. And there's been others like this. Used to be a company called Automatic that did something similar. That they did sell direct to consumers. They've since gone out of business. Verizon has offered a similar product made by Delphi that they call Hum. The Mojio system was available through T-Mobile and has a 4G radio in it and stuff like that. And I think the T-Mobile product is branded as SyncUp Drive. Well, what they're doing with Audi is for several hundred thousand Audi vehicles, they've got an adapter that they've developed that plugs into the OBD2 port. It's got a 4G radio in it, and it's also got accelerometers in that. And they've worked with Bosch. They've got Bosch's crash detection algorithms built into the firmware of the adapter. And so it can do things like emergency e-call. So if you get into a crash, it can automatically call 911 for you. It's also got a Bluetooth connection to the vehicle head unit. So you can use that, do the calling from the head unit through this device. It's got so basically all of the functionality that you currently have with the 3G connection, the telematics connectivity that we have with the 3G connection is replicated through this device, which provides the 4G connectivity.
So it's magic.
Yeah.
Well, it's not magic, but it's better than losing everything, which is what's happening as time, as technology marches forward. We sort of, things like this are going to probably continue to happen, especially with cars, because we keep them for so long, as opposed to your phone. I have a lot of old phones that won't connect to anything anymore, which is like, whatever, I don't use an old phone. But if I have an old car, and one of the reasons I bought the old car is because I could do certain things that involve the internet, and now I can't do those things because They're like, "Yeah, we're getting rid of 3G now." That's a huge bummer.
Yeah, I have an older car that has no connectivity at all, and I'm frankly just fine with that.
Yeah, outside of the Hyundai, everything else is just like doesn't have any connectivity. I mean, the Jaguar. I mean, it's lucky if the climate control works. And then the BRZ is like, it has something. I don't know what it has. It has a built-in map, so it has GPS. But it's got the worst like infotainment system on the face of the planet. Like the BRZ, the previous generation BRZ was not known for great infotainment system. it's pretty bad. But I can plug my phone in and it'll play music. And if I really stab hard at the screen, I can skip to the next song.
Oh, excellent!
So I got that going for me.
Perfect. Yeah. So the other manufacturers are also working on some solutions for this. Not every car with 3G radios is going to be able to be upgraded. I think Toyota and Lexus have said that they're not doing anything with theirs, but some companies like Subaru are doing some over-the-air updates and providing some hardware upgrades. GM's doing some stuff with some of their vehicles. So there's a bunch of 3G cars out there that will get upgrades. Others won't. Audi and Mojo have said that this one will be available starting in the new year. They've got a website for it, which is the product is they're calling it Motion for Audi Connect, and Audi Connect is Audi's branding for their connectivity system for their telematics. And there's a website called motionforaudiconnect.com where you can go and sign up for information when it becomes available early in the new year. And then once it does roll out, you'll be able, and you can also see on there which cars are eligible for this. And then that you'll be able to go to an Audi dealer and have it installed, for you. They haven't announced pricing yet. But they said it'll be competitive with other similar products and some owners probably won't have to pay any out of pocket costs at all. So it probably won't be any more than about $200 at most, which is what some of the other stuff is. And, some customers may get it for free.
Yeah. It's also, you sort of look at, if you have a car and it's from an automaker, it's like, yeah, we're not going to do anything. I wonder if that's going to make you think, I guess the next car is going to be from someone else who I see is doing something, so that at least some sort of future proofing of what's going to happen. Because the 4G is going to go away at some point. LTE is going to go 5G will come and go. That's just the nature of technology. We'll have like some sort of 8G or something in the far future. But yeah, it's.
Yeah, I mean we're going to start getting cars with 5G probably sometime in 2022. Some of the first vehicles with 5G. I think the BMW iX is going to have 5G in it, and there'll be others as well, and more rolling out from 2023 and beyond. I think one thing that's different now, now that we've gone through this a couple of times, these transitions. When those early transitions happened, the number of vehicles that had connectivity was still relatively small, but now that it's becoming standard on pretty much everything. Manufacturers actually, the conversations I've had with various manufacturers, they know that, that is something they're going to have to address in the future. And so they're actually designing them to be upgradable in the future so they can more easily replace the cellular data module, take that out and put in whatever the current latest generation is at some point in the future. So hopefully when we do, when the 4G networks get shut down, and that's probably not going to be for another at least 6 or 7 years, and maybe longer than that, then, the cars that are being built today will be able to be upgraded to 5G or 6G or something.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Sam, this was something I had to like search for and it took me too long. The Kona will charge it up to 77 kilowatts.
Oh, is it 77 kilowatts?
Okay. Yeah, just to give you a heads up. So if you want to go in and cut that whole part out.
Okay.
Yeah, it took me like forever to find it. Why don't they just put that on the goddamn side? They always just give you a time. I'm like, just give us a number. Just give us a number.
Well, the power in kilowatts is not something that's usually that meaningful to most people. They don't you know, what does it really mean? You know, they know how long it takes to fill their gas tank.
Yeah, but I think if they can look at the thing and it says this many kilowatts, you're like, how come it isn't going faster? But that car is, you know, why is my doing 50 and the other one's doing 70?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay.
Wanted to give you.
Next up, Ford. They've had some surprise, that more success than they anticipated with the Mustang Mach-E. When the Mach-E is built in Cuautitlan, Mexico, in the plant that used to build Fiestas. When they tooled up the plant last year to start production at the end of 2020, they initially tooled up, you know, anticipating about 50,000 units a year. You know, it turns out demand for the car was a lot more than they expected. So they had already made plans to increase that in 2022 beyond 50,000. And that's split about evenly between supply for North America and Europe. They have another plant in China that's actually building cars for the Chinese market. And the plan had been to, in 2023, they were going to launch electric versions of the Ford Explorer and Lincoln Aviator, also being built in Cuautitlan, off an upgraded version of the Mach-E platform. That's now been changed. The Aviator and Explorer EVs have been pushed back. They will not be built in Cuautitlan. And in fact, Ford has decided Jim Farley, the CEO, tweeted out the other day that, we're going to increase production of Mach-E to 200,000 units a year in Cuautitlan, and we're going to build the Aviator and Explorer EVs somewhere else. So those have been pushed back into 2024. What do you think?
It's a good EV. The first time I got the Mach-E, I was surprised because I was like, okay, this is going to be, you know, it's going to be fine. It was much better than I anticipated. And I think that's sort of, you know, I think between I think a lot of journalists, auto journalists, like it, and as word of mouth sort of got out, and more people started driving, they're like, "This is a really good EV." And I think I've seen more and more of them on the road. I drove the GT version a few months back. Time doesn't have any meaning; it could have been a few weeks. I'm not sure. Great little GT Ford. You can sit there and fight about the name, whether it's a Mustang or not, till the cows come home. It doesn't matter really. You can just say Mach-E. But it's, yeah, no, I this is, if you have an EV and it's doing really well, the last thing you're going to want to do is reduce the amount or just cap the amount you can sell. And it also, you know, I'm hearing from people who are looking at Teslas, Model Ys, and they're waiting like 6 months, a year to get their vehicle if they order it. And if Ford can just come in and be like, hey, look at this. You like the Model Y? You should try the Mach-E. And I think good for Ford for making a good car, and good for them for realizing that a lot of people want to buy it. I did have someone who sent me a message when Car and Driver named it the EV of the year, and they were like, "What is this?" I'm like, no, I completely agree with this. That's how good it is. So, yeah, I think it's a smart business move, and it's good for the adoption of EVs.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the only concern I have, you know, is that, because of this change, you know, they're pushing out the launch of the Explorer and Aviator, another year to 18 months, and you know, I think it would be good for Ford, you know, especially the Explorer. You know, I mean, that the Explorer is one of their best selling vehicles that isn't an F series pickup, and you know, having an electric vehicle of that type, you know, whether it looks exactly like the Explorer. A three-row SUV, electric SUV, I think would be really good for Ford. You know, and having to move that production to some other plant, you know, it's great, you know, that there's, you know, hopefully enough demand to support that. But, you know, I think it would be better for Ford, you know, if they were able to get that vehicle to market sooner. And maybe they will. Maybe they'll manage to tighten up that timeline and you know, get it out sooner than 2024.
I think they're big, you know, they're battling the ID Buzz, the ID, you know, the bus, and they're going to be battling the Hyundai 7 and the, I forget what the Kia is called, but
the EV9.
EV9. So those are sort of the other, you know, those. So it has to, they have to try to at least beat them or get to the market at the same time as those automakers. And I think they, you know, I think they probably do it. I think they're moving pretty quickly with I feel like they're moving quickly with their EV stuff than GM. GM had the Bolt out years ago and then just sort of like do. And then they showed us their, you know, Ultium 2 years ago. And it's just like, okay, come on.
Now we have the Hummer that's, you know, starting production now, and the Lyriq coming in the spring. And there's going to be eventually a bunch more stuff that we just haven't seen yet. Like we're going to see the Silverado EV in a few weeks at CES. But even that, you know, they said this week that, you know, that's not going to launch production until the beginning of 2023. So, you know, they're going to be, you know, nearly a year behind the F-150 Lightning in terms of, you know, launch timing for that.
Yeah, they're going to be having Lightning and Rivian, and probably on same amount of time as the Cybertruck, I'm guessing, at this point.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, and I right now it still feels like being first is a big deal. Eventually it's not going to really matter because there's going to be so many on the road. But right now it still feels like if you can get in there and you can get people, you know, dedicated to your brand, especially if you're a traditional automaker and you're trying to win back those Tesla customers and those Rivian customers. You know, if you can get in there quicker rather than later, that's good.
And sticking with EVs, you mentioned the VW ID. Buzz a minute ago. There was some news this week out of VW Commercial Vehicles, their commercial vehicles division, which is actually the division of Volkswagen that is going to be responsible for producing the ID. Buzz van, because they're going to offer it in a couple of different variations. There's going to be a passenger version, more like the concept that we saw a few years ago. And there's also going to be a van version, you know, panel van version for deliveries and things like that. And they're also doing an autonomous version with Argo's automated driving system that they're going to use as a robo-taxi. But the news out of VW Commercial Vehicles this week is that their plant in Hanover, Germany, that's producing the ID. Buzz will be producing the ID. California Camper.
Squee! Okay, so everyone loves that's why these things are so expensive. Even the old broke down ones that I find on eBay or on Craigslist are incredibly expensive, but like a Volkswagen bus that's a camper is just like everyone wants one, and now they're going to have an EV version, and it'll be interesting to see like how that plays out, just because you're going out in the middle of nowhere, you know charging. Are you going to be using your car to, you know, your van to power your Game Boy or whatever? Game Boy, jeez, I'm really old. Your Switch.
Well, you never know. I mean, you know, the Buzz has this kind of retro feel to it, retro vibe to it. Maybe you want to play a retro
game.
That's
true. I'm going to get my Xbox 360 out. I'm going to play some Halo. I'm going to get my Game Boy out and play some Tetris. So many people send me tweets and DMs and messages and emails that are friends of mine who are not really car people about the ID. Buzz. So now if an ID. Buzz California camper comes to the United States, people are going to lose their minds.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, my friend Mike Austin, who writes for Hemmings now, used to be at Car and Driver and at Hagerty. He lives not far away from me here. Last year, he bought a Eurovan camper.
Ooh.
Nice blue one. And I think that was the last generation that they sold here in North America. They've continued to offer the newer versions in Europe and other parts of the world, but they haven't sold them here. I think, and VW, you know, granted, has not said if the camper is going to come to North America, although the Buzz is going to be sold here. You know, so I would guess that they probably will offer the camper, and it's not going to be cheap. They never have been, but I think it's going to have a lot of appeal. I think a lot of people are going to like it.
I think they should have sold. I know that the regular California is like $106,000 or some crazy amount of money. I still think they could have sold at least 20,000 units here. It's a very expensive car. It's a low unit vehicle, but I still think they probably would have sold them. especially now, if they had decided to do it, and then especially with COVID and like van life, the rise of van life, I think they would have done gangbusters, because there's a lot of people with a lot of money who would have loved to go places but not have to deal with like hotels and airports and, you know, that sort of thing. So I think they can still, I think because people have been doing more road trips and have been doing more sort of van camping, I think that there is now a market where maybe there wasn't before.
Yeah, you know, if they offer some features like what Rivian's doing with the truck, you know, with the camp kitchen, something like that, I think, you know, that would be really appealing, especially in a van as opposed to a pickup truck. I think a lot of people would love that. I remember a couple of years ago, Jason Torchinsky from Jalopnik did a video review of the current generation California camper. That for some reason VW had brought some over.
They brought them here to drive, and they invited me, and I couldn't make it, and it was I was heartbreaking, and I was like, "But why? Why would you tease us?"
Jason did a great review, and I'll include that video in the show notes so you can check it out. Hopefully we do get the camper here in North America. All right, another EV that is coming eventually, maybe. Possibly, is the Cybertruck, which, you know, when it was announced, the same week as the Mach-E, you know, was supposed to come out this year, maybe it'll come out next year, more likely 2023, from what I've heard, you know, it's supposed to use Tesla's new larger 4680 battery cells, and they're having trouble scaling up production of those, and until those are ready. Although Elon has dropped a couple of news items about the Cybertruck in his Twitter feed recently, he did say that it will not come with any color options. The only way you can get it is just like the DeLoreans with bare stainless steel finish. So they'll keep their cost down by not having to have a paint shop for it. And also that the initial version, rather than the three-motor system that they originally promised, they originally spec'd out, which is basically the same powertrain that's in the the Model S Plaid, is actually going to come with a four-motor configuration like the Rivian, although presumably even more powerful than that. But we also saw this week flying a drone near a Tesla facility in California, got some photos of what may be the second Cybertruck prototype. You know, the original one that was shown, you know, that one was floating around for quite a while, but never, you know, we never saw any additional ones besides the original concept version. Now, you know, this new one has stuff like mirrors and a really big windshield wiper.
It's so... The arm... is like bigger than my leg. It looks so big, but it's one single wiper, so it's like whoosh, whoosh. And of course, you know, we're looking at a prototype still. But it might, you know, maybe it's the production rate. Maybe they'll change it out to two. Maybe they'll find a way to hide it. But right now it just sits straight up. So while you're driving as the driver, right there in your vision on the left-hand side of the windshield is a giant arm, just like whoop.
So right where we always have a blind spot anyway for the massive A-pillars on our vehicles.
Because so you have the A-pillar and the windshield wiper. So and of course these are spy shots from over, you know, it might eventually sit down. It might, you know, they might have a system where they can hide it. They might have a system where there's actually two of them at some point. But right now it's something.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem is, you know, especially when this, if you look at this overhead shot of the truck, you know, the windshield is massive compared to most vehicles because it, you know, slopes back. You know, when you look at the thing in profile, it's this basically flat surface from the nose all the way up to the peak of the roof, and most of that is the windshield. So you've got this giant, basically almost square windshield.
Yeah.
You know, unlike, you know, most windshields that are more rectangular, they're, you know, wider than they are tall. This thing is actually might be taller than it is wide, or it's very close to square.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in order to get coverage, to the top of the windshield from the base of the windshield. You really need something like this that stretches really long. And then, when you do that, unless you've got, if you were to put one on the other side, unless you've got them alternating, one sweeping and then coming back, and the
back
other
and
one
forth.
Comes down, they're going to be hitting each other. Or if you have them short enough, and so what you're going to end up with is like a quarter of this windshield is not going to be swept at all. When you look at the arc this thing's going to go through.
Yeah.
And also, because nobody makes windshield wiper blades that long, and it'd be hard to make, for that to be reliable, a wiper blade this long is probably more than 3 foot long. If you were to do it in one piece, it would have to be, almost 4 feet long. What they've got is one arm with two wiper blades on it that are kind of staggered a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's a really peculiar design, which is kind of a necessity because of the way they've designed the vehicle without, really thinking about, some of the actual functional aspects of it.
Yeah. It does feel like, hey, I got a great idea. Cool. Oh, shoot. We got to put like wiper blades and lights and, we have to, there's all these things that you have to have have on a car that you kind of sort of don't think about unless you're, someone who actually designs cars.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's something.
it certainly is.
I hope they figure out a way to keep it flat down. If it's like that, it takes away a lot from the design of the vehicle. B, I mean, that A-pillar is already going to be a pain because the windshield is already so sloped. So now you have this giant A-pillar and this thing in your way. I don't know. As someone who was at the event, and I can guarantee you that 95% of the people who were there when this vehicle hit the stage thought it was a joke.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
For the first 30 seconds... we'll see.
Yeah. And the other, the other problem is, you almost have to, because this thing is so massive, the wiper blade, you almost have to have it parked in the vertical position instead of down horizontal the way it typically would be, because, on most vehicles, you have, the back edge of the hood, you can kind of tuck it in under the back edge of the hood. So it's out of the airstream, For this thing, you don't have that. You've just got this continuous surface from the short little stubby hood into the glass. And if you parked it in a horizontal position, the aerodynamics would be terrible.
Oh, yeah.
So, it's kind of the worst of all worlds.
They almost have to – I don't know what they're going to do. Because you either have to – create that little cubby, like you said, between the hood and the windshield in some way or another in order to hide this. Because, especially if you want this thing, we're putting we're putting four motors in it. Yeah. It's going to go 0 to 60 in some ungodly quick speed. Yeah, you know, that thing's just going to pop, plop off.
Yep.
It really the cubby would do less to destroy the sort of aesthetics of this than having a big giant arm in your way the whole time. I think the arm is bad news for the aesthetics of this vehicle because people are buying it for, yeah, you know, it looks like the 70s idea of what the future would be like. It's a 70s, you know, dystopian future vehicle. And if suddenly, like, the 70s dystopian vehicle just has this big goofy like arm, yeah, on it, well, there you go.
Yeah, it's, yeah, you know, this is exactly why, you know, we've always had complaints from people. You know, they see all these cool cars on, you know, concept cars on auto show stands. It's like, why don't they ever build those? Stuff like this is why they don't build concept cars, yeah, the way they look on the auto show stand. You know, because the design ideas, you know, always clash with reality. So.
Yeah, there's always, even when you with the X5, or no, I'm sorry, the XM, you know, they were like, oh, this is 90% there, but there's a lot of stuff that we have on this concept car that won't pass the muster regulatory wise. Like, they had like a smoked glass in the front to put the license plate behind, just for the concept. And they were very like, we couldn't do this in the real world. This is only for the concept vehicle. So they were very, BMW was very upfront about, there's some things on here that we just can't do because it's illegal.
Yeah.
Or it's just not, you know, it looks cool, but it's just not plausible in the real world. So I think Tesla, I know Elon Musk has said, you know, everyone gets really upset when they see this vehicle, you know, you see a concept vehicle and then the production vehicle comes out and doesn't look anything like it. But I think automakers over the past decade or so have really started working on that, where it's like 10% different. It's not like, you know, drastically different like it used to be. But you I think as an automaker for Tesla, they have to sort of understand that the concept vehicle, you can change it a little bit. It doesn't have to look exactly like the thing you drove up on stage and put a hole in. This, it can change a little bit.
Yeah.
For the benefit of everyone who wants to buy it.
Okay. Let's stick with Elon for a minute. one of the things going on in Congress right now is, you know, this battle over the Build Back Better Act, which includes changes to the EV incentive program that we've had since 2010. You know, the current program allows for a federal tax credit of up to $7,500 on EVs, and the amount depends on the size of the battery. So at once you get above 16 kilowatt hour battery pack, you're maxed out at that $7,500. And then below that, it's scaled based on the size of the pack. And it's been limited to the first 200,000 sales for a manufacturer. Once they get past 200,000, they phase it out. Tesla and General Motors have already phased out. They no longer have any tax credits available. The new program will lift that 200,000 cap, so they'll be able to get incentives again. There's still $7,500 is the base tax credit, but to get that, you now have to have a minimum of 40 kilowatt hour battery pack, which, you know, is fine. I mean, you know, that's for modern EVs. That's kind of the bottom end. You know, the base Nissan Leaf has a 40 kilowatt hour pack, you know, so that would get the $7,500, and everything else is pretty much larger than that now. Plug-in hybrids are still eligible, but they also have to hit that 40 kilowatt hour level, and they're limited to get a tax credit. They can't have a gas tank of more than 2.5 gallons. So basically, it's more like, you know, what BMW did with the i3 range extender, where it's really only for emergency use. It's not for, you know, your daily driving around, like the way most plug-in hybrids are probably used. And then, in addition to the $7,500, they've added a couple of other things. There's $4,500 additional that's available for EVs that are built in U.S. plants with union labor, which basically means anything, you know, built by Ford, General Motors, or Stellantis in the U.S. And no other vehicles right now would be eligible for that, including Tesla. They would be limited to the $7,500. And then there's another $500 for cars with US-built batteries. So conceivably, Tesla and some other manufacturers could get that $500, but not the $4,500. So in an interview earlier this week with the Wall Street Journal, with Joanna Stern at the Wall Street Journal, Elon said, you know, we should just get rid of incentives entirely. We don't need them anymore. We've got too much of a budget deficit. Now that, you know, Tesla's got a huge lead in the EV market, we took advantage of the incentives, built up our market share, and we want to pull up the ladder behind us. Nobody else should get any incentives. What do you think?
It is insane that he would, that is someone who's gotten a lot of support from both federal and state government, that he would be like, we don't need those anymore. And the idea that, I think he's upset about the union thing, which is weird, because I mean, people have been trying to unionize at Tesla for a while, and you know, that's always, that was a big issue a few years ago. And of course, you know, as most companies, they don't want a union. They don't want collective bargaining. They don't want solidarity within the employee ranks in order to help, you know, everyone get a fair shake on the floor. So, but you know, I'm a big supporter of unions. I think more people should be able to collectively bargain with their bosses, who are making a lot of money. The gap between the average employee and the CEO's pay is sort of ridiculous. And how much money Elon is worth is it's for him to like sort of like, oh, you know, especially after he got all these, you know, and they're like, well, we paid back our loans. Yeah, but you got the loans.
Yeah. Got the loans, and, you know, almost all of whatever profit they've recorded in the last several years has come not from actually building cars, but from selling the ZEV tax credits to other manufacturers that haven't been able to sell as many EVs as Tesla has. Yeah, and that's another subsidy. He didn't mention that particular subsidy, whether that should go away. I mean, if you're going to get rid of the tax credits, you should also get rid of that ability to sell the credits as well.
Yeah. So it's extremely hypocritical of him to sort of like, well, we're doing fine. Yeah, you're doing fine. Because you were built on the back of the US taxpayer. And you know, and that's fine. If that's what we need to make the world not as polluted as it was, so fewer kids are born, you know, are raised and end up getting asthma because they live near you know, freeways or whatnot. Cool. Yeah, that's fine. You know, the reason we have a government is to protect the populace, and protecting the populace in means reducing carbon emissions. And it's sort of insane, especially when he's like, well, I think there was a tweet about how, well, Tesla employees, they make a lot of money. Last Christmas, there was a email out. They were trying to push sales or push production. And part of that push was asking people to volunteer, for employees to volunteer, not get paid, between Christmas and New Year's, to help push production, to help move cars around. And there's been times where people have been told, oh, by the way, we're shutting down your line for a few weeks. You'll get paid this much, but these other weeks, I don't know, figure it out. Figure out if you can pick up some extra shifts. If he had a union, that wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah.
The idea that you're like, your boss just sends you an email and says, oh, by the way, in 3 weeks, we don't need you at work, and you can get a little bit of money, but not enough money for that entire time that you're off. That's a company that needs a union. That's a company that needs someone who's looking out for those employees, and Tesla has been very anti that. And if that stuff wasn't happening, if everyone had, you know, if there wasn't lawsuits against Tesla for racism, for misogyny, maybe it would, and they hadn't been built on the back of government subsidies, you could say or look at his tweets and be like, all right, well, at least he's on brand. But no, this is insanely hypocritical for him.
Yeah. And, the reality is that most likely, you know, I mean, this bill has been passed by the House, but it has not passed through the Senate yet. And I think that there's a strong probability that that $4,500 component, at least, you know, for union-built EVs, may get cut from the bill. I have a hard time believing that the Senate, especially, you know, given that it's more or less 50-50, is going to pass that version of it. you know, because there's also a lot of pressure, not just from Tesla, but from other manufacturers, you know, from pretty much everybody that isn't GM, Ford, or Stellantis, you know, is opposed to that part of the program, because none of the, you know, whether it's, you know, Hyundai, Kia, Toyota, you know, Toyota and Honda have a lot of plants in North America, including in the U.S., none of which are unionized. BMW and others, none of them like that, because they would all lose out on the potential to get that that incentive. They, you know, they can get the $7,500, but they can't get the that $4,500 component. So I think that there's a good chance that that's probably going to get cut from the bill anyway.
Yeah, and it's a bummer, but I also think that the 200,000 cap was sort of unfair. It punished Tesla and GM for doing a good job.
Yeah,
like, hey, good job, we're not going to help you anymore, which was unfair. Like, I could get my Hyundai, or if you get, you know, if you went out and bought an MX-30 from Mazda, you're going to get a tax credit.
Yeah,
Mazda's waited forever. If you get, you know, you get a Solterra from Subaru, you get a tax credit. But because they just waited for a long time to do this, whereas, you know, GM and Tesla were like, oh, we're on the forefront. We're trying to make the world a better place, you know, either for because they care about humans or they care about profit or whatever. To sort of like, oh, by the way, no more for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the original rationale there was, you know, they figured that, you know, they figured that manufacturers would hit that 200,000 a lot sooner than they did. Mm-hmm. And they figured, okay, by the time, you know, every manufacturer is selling 200,000 EVs, you know, you'll have enough critical mass, you know, that you won't have to keep incentivizing them, you know, that people will buy EVs regardless. And that just turned out not to be the case. You know, most manufacturers didn't sell EVs as aggressively as certainly as Tesla, and to a far lesser degree, you know, GM did. And even after that, they didn't, you know, there wasn't enough momentum yet. I mean, that's starting to happen now, as we start to get a lot more different EVs in the marketplace, especially in coming in 2022. But we just never had enough momentum to really have it have sales keep going without incentives.
Yeah, I think they felt like all the automakers would hit that 200,000 like limit around the same time, and the reality is really just two, and then everyone else is just sort of lagging behind.
Yeah. All right. Next up, let's see. That's it. That's all the stories. And then we've got a few listener questions. Start off with Andrew Pappas. Said, how has the parts shortage slowing car manufacturing affected the companies not experiencing shortages? Are the car makers warehousing parts? Are they canceling orders? Where else is there fallout in the supply chain? It varies. The biggest issue for automakers has obviously been on semiconductors, on chips. And in some cases, some manufacturers, most notably Toyota, actually did have, you know, some bigger stockpiles of chips that they got early on. And that reduced their disruption. Although now they're starting to run out of those parts, and they're, you know, they're experiencing more disruptions now than they did earlier on. So, you know, it varies. It varies across the industry, but most of them are being impacted to some degree or another now. You know, others, you know, they've found ways around it by, you know, eliminating the availability of certain features like wireless charging pads and Super Cruise and heated seats and
touchscreens.
Yeah, and touchscreens. Yeah, and BMWs. You know, so they're leaving out features where they think they can get away with it, or where, you know, they can perhaps say, look, we're going to leave this out now so we can ship the cars, and we will, you know, go back and retrofit your car next year whenever we get the parts, and you'll get that feature back. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag, but pretty much everybody's being impacted to some degree or another.
Yeah, it's tough, especially if you're trying to buy a car. I just keep telling people don't buy a car if you don't have to right now, just because they're so expensive. I mean, I saw the markup of a RAV4 Prime. It was like 10. When we were looking for a car, they were $10,000. And a Toyota dealership that's in the Bay Area that told me at one point they don't ever mark up, theirs was $7,000 for a RAV4 Prime, which was, you know, the RAV4 Prime was always going to be in short supply the first year. They said before the shortage that they were going to be in short supply. So now with the shortage going on, it's tough. And that's from, again, and that's from a company that was, you know, they had some saved up. So when it's, you're only as quick as your slowest supplier, which is a bummer for a lot of these automakers and for people who need, you know, cars, and now they're buying used cars, and which is, you know, I'm a big fan of buying a used car because you're keeping that vehicle on the road and it's less expensive, but some people want the security of a new vehicle that, because they have to get to work every day, and I completely understand that.
I feel bad. Somebody in my neighborhood this morning when I was walking my dog, I noticed we had a big windstorm that came through yesterday, 60, 65 mile an hour gusts. And there was a big chunk of tree next to their driveway that was sitting across the roof of their Ford Taurus this morning.
Their Ford Taurus?
Yeah, like early 2010s.
Wow.
Crushed the roof. That thing's going to be a write-off, unfortunately.
The Taurus, a number one selling car in America for a while, but they were pretty disposable. You don't see a lot of Ford Taurus rolling around.
This is the latest, the last generation. Yeah. Taurus, not the earlier ones.
That's a bummer though. When you have a car that you're like, hey, this is working for us. It's used. You're the gravy years. You're just fixing little things here and there if you're lucky. Yep. And then to have that happen, that's,
So they're going to have to go find something, unfortunately. All right, next one, Yakov Nimoy, who we had a fairly long email last week, and this one is just slightly less verbose, but it's trying to get through it. So this is a continuation of the discussion we had about keyless entry and digital keys and key fobs and so on. It says, hey, folks, happy to hear my long rant got airtime in the most recent episode, so thank you for that. I promise this is brief this time. Well, he wrote that before he finished the email. First off, everyone on the show is right in that you all know what's the best setup for yourselves. I don't see keys completely going away, and any decently secure system needs some kind of physical object that you can show your phone app. Yes, this is my car. This is also providing a great way to hand off custody of a vehicle to someone without handing off the whole vehicle. A few things, though. To be very clear, the phone should connect directly to the car with no cloud in between. I'm actually one of those people who works on the cloud all day long, and I refuse to use any hardware that can't dock directly to my phone at home. The internet is just not reliable for this. This is actually a requirement of Apple's HomeKit protocol. I think we'll see all the smart hardware vendors switch to handling communication entirely locally within the next 5 years. Everyone is sick of waiting 3 seconds for lights to turn on. Also regarding iPhones, all your personal data is encrypted on device and it cannot be unlocked without your passcode. When you wipe your phone via the Settings app, the device actually just destroys the intermediate encryption keys, so even with your passcode, that encrypted data is unreadable. I actually recommend using this feature after backing up your phone or computer before sending your expensive gizmo for service and repair to make sure not even Apple employees can access your data on your phone. Android supports similar things, but I'm fuzzy on the details. Keyless entry with a phone isn't something everyone will use, but if it does work correctly, it enables folks who might have to decide between carrying a key or a phone with them. Even if a phone is bigger than a key fob, there are folks, not me, these people think in ways foreign to me, who care about carrying the fewest things possible. And anything that gets them closer to minimalism is desirable. Lastly, we have the activity bracelet on our Range Rover, and let's just say I totally understand these things fail and hard, and I've nearly stranded my family that way. This future is totally not here. Personally, I wish everyone would do the keypad feature Ford has had for years.
Those are all correct. As someone who used to cover both InfoSec and Home, like the connected home and, I guess, the Internet of Things, that is all correct information, so Yakov knows his stuff. The secure elements on your phone should connect to the secure elements in your car and not have to deal with the cloud. But I don't think automakers are quite there yet. I think they're still, they're excited about the cloud. You know, like other people were like a couple of years ago. So they're like, yeah, everything can just go through the cloud. Or like, yeah, everything doesn't need to go through the cloud.
Yeah.
And that Range Rover bracelet, I tried it once. They sent me a Range Rover and I just could not get it to work, which is, and then that right there, you're like, oh my gosh, especially if you're someone who likes to do some sort of, like, I like to surf. Mm-hmm. A modern key is a bad scene for surfing because it's a little computer in your pocket. Essentially, it's a tiny little, you know, one job computer in your pocket. And if you get it wet and now you're stuck at the beach in a wetsuit with a surfboard and you're like, oh no, my phone's in that car.
Yeah.
And I was, yeah, the keypad, we need more keep. A friend of mine moved his keypad off his Bronco. He took it off one spot and put it somewhere else.
Really?
You can do that. Yeah. They're not like attached to wires or anything.
Oh, it's not wired. It's wireless.
No, you just pull it. You can pull it off and put it somewhere else. And that would be awesome if you could do that with other cars. Like, I think more cars should have keypads like the Ford, where you can just like take it and maybe put it like, you know, in a little, if you don't, well, if you're gas cap or the door doesn't require the car to be unlocked, you could put it in there. If you could put it maybe under the little cubby of the trunk.
Yeah, I mean, there's always places.
Yeah, there's always places you could sort of stash it, and that way it cleans up the aesthetic of the car, but you're still able to get into the car when you don't have your key, because you're like boop 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 boop, and that's just, yeah.
Yeah, on Lincolns, they actually use a capacitive touchpad that's built into the pillar, so that when it's off, you don't see it at all. When you touch the pillar,
oh yeah,
then it lights up and you can tap the numbers. So, you know, that way they get a cleaner look, but you still have the same functionality.
Yeah. See, more little buttons that I can just push.
Yeah.
I mean, that's also an InfoSec thing, because someone could just stand near you and see it and then wait till the next time you show up to the beach and then steal all your stuff. But yeah, everything's, the world's a crazy place.
It sure is. All right. Last one is from Brianna Wu. Clearly, you know, Brianna's got a little too much time and money on her hands. thinking about buying a Ferrari California, but worried about reliability. Are they really as bad as their reputation? That, and I just think they're really beautiful. So I have not personally owned a Ferrari, at least not a full-size functional one. I've got a number of, you know, Hot Wheels-sized Ferraris. Have you heard anything about the reliability of the California?
Not the California in general. I think that just because they're such a niche automaker. But I do know that if you need any work done to a Ferrari, be prepared to wait a long time. I was doing an Acura NSX video shoot, and a gentleman showed up on his very expensive bicycle, and he said, oh, yeah, I have a Ferrari. And he's like, and we were sort of talking about the difference between Ferrari and Acura. I'm like, yeah, this you can just take to the Acura dealership. And they're everywhere. And he was like, yeah, it's going to take me 4 months to get an oil change on my Ferrari. And my friend's Ferrari broke, and they had to send it back to Italy, which is going to take 18 months for that to happen. And so you're sort of like, okay, well, so it's a Ferrari. It's Italian. Italians make beautiful cars. But then there's also, you know, I hate to say that there's the reputation of Italian cars not being as sturdy as, say, a Porsche 911, which Brianna is a huge fan of.
Yeah.
I think Brianna's experience with her Porsches is not going to be the same as her experience with the Ferrari California. And I think, Ferrari California is beautiful and wonderful. But I think if you can afford a Ferrari California, you have to be able to afford two Ferrari Californias. I think that's how.
Well, if you have a Ferrari California and four Porsches, then, you know, you pretty much got it covered. You're still going to have something that you can drive every day.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. So while the Ferrari's in the shop or in your garage, then you still have your Porsches. So
yeah, and you know, it sounds like, you know, it's kind of like when you go to the dentist, you know, for your biannual cleaning or your semi-annual cleaning. You know, usually, you know, after they finish cleaning your teeth and you have your checkup and everything, you know, then they said you want to schedule, go ahead and schedule your next appointment. It's the same thing when you get an oil change with your Ferrari. You get an oil change and then you meet at the time before you drive away, you schedule your next oil change so that, you know, by the time it's time for that, you're good to go.
I just like the idea of someone I know having a Ferrari in California also. So now I'm just going to tell Brando, you should totally buy it because I want to be able to say, I have a friend who owns a Ferrari in California.
There you go. There,
and a bunch of 911s. But yeah, it's definitely, if you can afford one, you should be. I think Ferraris in general, any supercar outside of like a Porsche, if you can afford one, you should be able to, if you want to buy one, you should be able to afford two of them. Because yeah. There's going to be
chances are, you know, even if you don't have two of the same thing, you know, if you can afford something like that, chances are you've got other vehicles that
yeah.
you can choose from. So there's always something available in the garage to drive.
Like people and, with Bugattis don't just own a Bugatti.
Yeah.
They have like 60 other cars.
And you know, it's going back to 2007 when I first interviewed Martin Eberhard, the actual founder of Tesla. we were talking about, you know, the rationale for doing a sports car, the original Tesla Roadster, before something somewhat more mainstream. And, you know, that was the argument he made, is that, you know, doing an expensive premium car like that, you know, the customers that can afford to buy a car like that and are willing to buy a car like that tend to be more tolerant of the foibles of these kind of expensive cars. And they usually don't have just one car. They usually have multiple cars. So even if it has some issues and has to spend some time in the shop, you know, those customers have a level of tolerance that ordinary consumers like you and I don't have. And so, you know, the same thing I think is still very much true today.
Yeah. I think people who bought the first generation Model S were totally like, they were very much first adopters and wanted to be on the cutting edge. But those people were more tolerant of any sort of issues that they would have with that vehicle versus the person buying a Model 3.
Yeah. All right. That's almost everything we have for this week. I also, in my ongoing series of interviews that I did at the LA Auto Show, the latest one is with Rob Filipovich, who is the director of product planning for Jaguar Land Rover North America. Rob and I sat in the back of one of the brand new fifth generation Range Rovers on the show floor, and had a conversation about the new Range Rover, as well as, you know, kind of where Jaguar Land Rover is going over the next 5-10 years, with Jaguar going to be transitioning to all electric from 2025, what Range Rover or the Land Rover brand, including Range Rover and Land Rover vehicles, is doing. So stick around to listen to that. Some good stuff in there. And we'll talk to you next week with Nicole, and we'll talk all about the Hyundai Ioniq 5.
It's going to be Ioniq 5-tastic. I don't think that's a word, but it's going to be fun. And pie. We'll talk more about pie.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Bye.
Bye.
So let's start off, Rob, with discussion of this vehicle, the new Range Rover. This is what, fifth or sixth generation?
Fifth generation. Yeah. 50 years of Range Rovers.
Yeah, it's amazing how the design has evolved, and yet you look at it and you still see the Range Rover in this thing. You look at it, it's instantly recognizable as a Range Rover. So what's the overall strategic direction with Range Rover with this particular model? What are you trying to achieve with this, and how are you evolving the brand?
Yeah, so for us, the key with Range Rover, obviously, it is to us the leader in luxury SUV. From our view, it was the original, and it needs to kind of continue to evolve to continue to stay in that leadership role. And so from the infancy of this product and the new vehicle, it really was about kind of how do we just continue that evolution. And that's where you see that instant recognizability. Mm-hmm. You'll see a lot of, I think, familiarity on the exterior and the interior, but it's equally how do we just keep making it better. Mm-hmm. And that is in every single aspect of the vehicle.
So obviously, you know, technology is becoming an increasingly important part of all vehicles. Moving towards this idea of the software-defined vehicle. How is that is that something that you're fitting into Range Rover now, and how's that working out?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And there's multifaceted, of course. So we have our Pivi Pro system, which we launched in the Defender, including the full software over-the-air capability. Now what we're doing is kind of continuing to evolve that and make it even better. So with Range Rover, we're introducing wireless CarPlay, wireless Android Auto, Sirius XM 360L, as well as a full Alexa integration. And that's a full integration where you can just log into your account in the vehicle, and then it's fully connected to your account and everything else you have connected to that account as well, from home lighting to garages to anything else you have at home.
And in the premium SUV utility, whatever term you want to use for, I guess first of all, for Land Rover, do you consider this an SUV or a sport activity vehicle? What is your preferred terminology for this vehicle?
It is absolutely an SUV.
Okay, so in the premium SUV segment is getting increasingly crowded, with both. Legacy brands moving up into the segment, like Jeep with the Wagoneer, Grand Wagoneer, really trying to challenge Range Rover, and then newcomers coming in, particularly from the electrification side, with brands like Rivian and Lucid doesn't have their SUV yet, but they will next year. How do you keep Range Rover, in particular, competitive with all of these challengers?
The key for us really is that leadership position and continuing to evolve and improve the overall formula. And so it's that side of...
Sorry about that. No problem. Go ahead.
So I think for us it really is that end of maintaining that leadership position and keep it continuing to push it further. And I think competition is always a good thing. Keeps you honest, keeps you getting better all the time. And so for us, I think it's that side of how do we stay that one step ahead and continue to be that kind of that pinnacle of SUV luxury and refinement and capability as well when it comes even to off-roading. So I think for us, we've kind of really established Range Rover as that ultimate expression of a luxury SUV, and we just need to continue to push it forward.
Do you see, especially the new challengers, being, because their focus is really on the, in many cases, on the technology side, in addition to electrification. How, do you see them being a significant threat to the brand?
Obviously, I think there's threats all over the place, from some of the incumbent OEMs to some of the new generation of brands. I think for us, it's that side of we've obviously kind of established an extremely loyal customer base. I think it's how do we continue to keep them happy and satisfied, not only from the vehicle itself, but also from the overall customer experience we give them on a day-to-day basis, both through ourselves as well as the fantastic retail franchise network that we have out there taking care of people. So I think it's for us, competition's always healthy, and it'll just keep making us get better and better and make that customer experience for us keep on getting better and better as well.
So let's step back from Range Rover a little bit to Jaguar Land Rover as a whole.
Yep.
And how the strategy for the company is evolving. You launched the iPace a couple of years ago. It had some success, some degree of success. And there was supposed to be an electric XJ, which unfortunately got canceled. How does JLR move forward? What's JLR's place in the world in 2025, 2030?
Yeah, so I think obviously two brands, two different strategies going forward. I think everything obviously exists under this reimagined strategy that we've announced. As it relates to Jaguar, that's an all-electric future. So starting in 2025, we will be all-electric on the Jaguar brand. Along with that, we'll be taking the brand back up market as well. So really establishing it as kind of a completely new experience and a really kind of a new generation of Jaguar. I think that's kind of learns from the past in terms of some of the greatest successes that Jaguar has, but is also completely future thinking. So not using the history to kind of limit ourselves, but kind of being more inspired by it and kind of going in a new direction for the brand that's ready for the future.
Yeah, the Jaguar brand has been fascinating to watch over the years. For a long time, it was this very traditional British luxury mixed with very impressive performance and comfort. Kind of a blend of a lot of things. You got elements, especially on the comfort side, you got elements you didn't get from, say, the German premium mm-hmm. brands. And then a few years ago, the brand lowered prices, tried to get a little more value in the brand. Has that not worked out? And you mentioned going back more upmarket. How far upmarket do you foresee taking the Jaguar brand?
Yeah, certainly not that it didn't work out. I think it was a time period, I think, where for us it certainly brought a lot of conquest. It brought a lot of new people into the brand, which was key for us. It was also at a time when the industry was going through a tremendous transition from sedans and coupes and convertibles into crossovers and SUVs. And so I think for us it was kind of a good period of time where we had some good success with F-Type. F-Pace obviously became our best seller, so it's been a very good kind of informative period. I think now it's kind of how do we get the brand ready for the next decade and beyond, and that's kind of where it's looking at kind of where we can kind of take that brand again in a different direction, and kind of have it ready for the future. And I think that's kind of the key for Jag is that it has kind of been constantly evolving over time, and I think kind of there's certainly been some ups and downs in terms of some of the historic product. But I think it's kind of, let's just keep looking forward in terms of what we think and what we know from consumers in terms of what they want out of the Jaguar brand in the future.
Is there still a place for cars in the Jaguar brand of 2025, or is it all some flavor of utility?
No, I think as a whole, there's room for all shapes of vehicles. And I think that's the absolute beauty of especially the North American market, but even the global market is... not everyone is looking for the exact same thing. And kind of obviously car demand has been reduced, but there's still plenty of people out there buying cars. And just as there's plenty of people buying crossovers and SUVs and pickup trucks and everything else. So I think it's the beauty of that diversity in what people want. And then what's within all of that diversity, what are the right portions of the market we want to go after?
What kind of time frame do you see for bringing... starting to bring these new EVs to the Jaguar brand? Is that something in the next 12 months, maybe 23, 24 time frame?
Yeah. No, so for the Jaguar, it'll be 2025.
Okay, by 2025, you're all electric. But yeah. Will we start seeing some of those models arriving in the years leading up to that?
No, it'll be that time frame.
Okay. Kind of what we see today continuing to evolve for the next few years.
Yeah, and even today, we'll continue to improve the current lineup, and I think as we've been doing over the last few years, in terms of the major updates we did on the XF and the F-Pace, mm-hmm. I-Pace, we continue to improve the overall, I think, fit, finish, value experience that you have out of that vehicle as well. And then even F-Type, just this year, we're launching the P450, the mm-hmm. V8 version as a replacement to both the 4 and the 6-cylinder and enhancing the fun and performance of that vehicle. So I think for us, it's not about kind of now just waiting. It's really about how do we continue to improve the existing lineup, bring more fans into the brand, and then kind of evolve and go into the new generation of Jaguar from there.
For those electric vehicles, do you see those platforms being developed internally at JLR, or are you looking at partnerships to share the development costs and share componentry? And especially with EV, as you get into EVs, one of the challenges is it's harder to distinguish and get product differentiation with electric propulsion compared to engines, that can sound and feel different. Yeah. Do you see that as a way to help spread out some of those costs?
Yeah, so I think there's multiple pieces there. I think one, obviously we're big advocates of partnership. So I can't comment on kind of on the future Jags, what'll be a part through a partnership, what'll be internally developed. But obviously BMW as an example. We have a relationship and a partnership with. But we're very kind of focused on who are the right partners, what are the right things to do in-house, and kind of being able to bring together the best minds to bring out the best product at the end of the day. So that really is a focal point for us, of having that right blend of partnership development as well as kind of the right supply chain, and then having the right development in-house as well. On the EV side now, I think what's interesting there is there's still a tremendous amount of opportunity in terms of how you even tune those EVs, that you can create very distinct driving capabilities and very distinct driving experiences as well. And I think that's that next great piece that'll start to evolve, which is how you tune those things differently to get kind of, whether it's how the vehicle, the tip-in, the regeneration, again, all of the handling dynamics, the steering feel. So I think there's still a huge amount of bandwidth in terms of how you can equally change the way that an EV can feel depending on the product line and the brand.
Is JLR going to continue to develop the in-house Ingenium engine lineup, or, you know, you've already, for this vehicle, you've switched to a BMW-based V8 engine, or are you going to transition across your engine lineup to BMW-sourced engines going forward?
No plan on that. I think we're extremely happy with our Ingenium lineup between the 4 and 6 cylinders, and kind of what we've been able to do with those, the refinement, performance, and fuel efficiency that they brought. I think on the V8 side, we saw a great opportunity again there to partner with BMW. They had a fantastic engine to start with. And then from there, we were able to kind of take it in our own direction and build it to our own requirements as well, where it's able to take even more abuse, whether it be related to our curb strike test, the additional changes that were made to it so that it can, in this vehicle, wade through up to 3 feet of water. So there's a lot of things that we do still, even within those partnerships, to make sure that it really is a Land Rover engine and a Land Rover execution at the end of the day.
Okay. Electrification on the Land Rover side of the business, you've got mild hybrid. That's kind of standard now, right? On all your powertrains, all your or options.
It's a mixture. So our P300 Ingenium 4-cylinders have mild hybrid, as well as our inline sixes. So we have that, and then we have plug-in hybrid, as well as a completely updated plug-in hybrid that's going to be coming in this new Range Rover. And then from there, we'll introduce a fully electrified Range Rover in 2024.
Okay, so that's when we'll see the first full battery electric Range Rover. All right, and is there a time frame for taking the Land Rover brand vehicles all electric? Jaguar from 2025. The rest of the what's the time frame there?
Yeah, not a specific time frame to go fully electric and electric only. But starting in 2024, we'll have the all electric Range Rover, and with. Within the kind of 4 years, 5 years that follow that, we'll have another 6 fully electrified Land Rovers within the brand. So it's definitely going to be kind of a major expansion of electrification within the Land Rover brand as well.
So that 2024, that's based on this vehicle here that we're sitting in.
Okay. Absolutely.
All right. Let's see what else. I think that covers most of what I want to talk about. Anything else, you know, with JLR that people should be thinking about, you know, as far as, you know, how the brands and the vehicles are going to evolve, or you know, what you want to do with these going forward?
Yeah, I think fundamental for us is staying true to the brand. And on Land Rover, obviously, the most important thing for us is that combination of luxury and capability. And that's that side of it's kind of continuing to improve and enhance it and kind of really push it further, whether it be with the Range Rover that we're in now, or the Defender that we launched last year, and making sure that we have the right kind of vehicles out there for an extremely diverse group of consumers. And so for us, it'll just be how we push those vehicles further and further every single time, every single year.
I guess one last area I wanted to ask you about is motorsports. You know, Jaguar has a long history of involvement in motorsports and going back many decades. And for the last, 6 years or so, you've been a key participant in Formula E. Do you see expanding that, you know, as electric motorsports continues to expand? We've got electric GT coming, various other electric formula coming. Do you see a potential for expansion of the Jaguar brand into some other segments of motorsports, or for, you know, Range Rover, you know, maybe something like Extreme E for, you know, for the Range Rover brand? Is that something that might be in the cards at some point?
Nothing at the moment. The focus for us continues to be on Formula E, on the Jaguar side of the business, and continuing to kind of improve and push ourselves further there. I think there's some other great forums that are building out there. You mentioned the Extreme E as one. But at the moment, we don't have any plans to go and enter that.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Rob.
No, thank you.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.